Hello and welcome to our program, The Advocates, on WJUP 103.9 FM, and Happy New Year to all. My name is Richard J. Garfunkel. I'm the host of this weekly forum. The program is coming from the studios of WJUP in sunny Jupiter, Florida, on the Treasure Coast of Florida. My guest this first Sunday in 2016, we got to get used to that, is Dr. Chris Bryseth, and our subject is Frances Perkins, her vision of the New Deal, its social and economic purpose, and the challenge from the right to these institutions that we worked quite hard to establish. Welcome, Chris, back to The Advocates, and thank you for joining me today.
It's a delight to be with you, Richard.
Thank you. You know, meanwhile, as I say each week, the mission of The Advocates is to bring to the public differing views on current public policy issues and the state of economic justice in America, and the role of Frances Perkins must never be forgotten or ignored. Today's challenges from the right may be the greatest and most dangerous that the average American has seen to their hard-earned rights, safety nets, and retirement security in 70 years. My guest, Dr. Chris Bryseth, is the new chairperson of Frances Perkins Center in Maine. He is the past president and CEO of the Franklin Eleanor Roosevelt Institute, which is located at the FDR Presidential Library and Museum in, of course, Hyde Park, New York. He served in that position from 2001 to 2008. He's the past president of both Deep Springs College and Wilkes University. He earned his BA in history at UCLA, a Master's of Literature in Modern British History from Oxford, that's in England, by the way, and a PhD in European History from Cornell. While at Cornell, he lived at the Telluride House, where Frances Perkins was a guest the last 5 years of her life. And for the people who don't know who Frances Perkins was, she was one of the great secretaries of labor, if not the greatest, that we've had in our country's history. During that period, she taught at the School of Industrial and Labor Relations. Together, Bryseth and Miss Perkins organized two seminars for their House members, one with Henry A. Wallace, of course, the former vice president, the other with James Farley, the former postmaster general. Following Miss Perkins' death in 1965, Bryseth wrote an article, The Frances Perkins I Knew, which provides some of the material on Frances Perkins' life at Telluride House for Kirsten Downey's book, The Woman Behind the New Deal, which I have right in my right hand here, and I'm going to drop it on the table. It's a very big book, and it's a great book. Chris Bryseth was first a guest on The Advocate 6 years ago in 2009. I've had the pleasure of the company and wisdom of his thoughts every 2 years since. When FDR invited Frances Perkins to be a Secretary of Labor, she brought with her a hastily written laundry list of ideas which he would expect his support if he were to accept, this appointment. FDR agreed, and she began 12 years as a Secretary of Labor. Throughout these years, and some of them during the height of the Great Depression, she worked tirelessly and accomplished a huge number of reforms, establishing programs for American workers. Among Frances Perkins' major and best-known achievements during her long tenure, I think the longest tenure of any cabinet officer, was the establishment of Social Security. FDR called it the cornerstone of his administration. I can't imagine anybody in America wouldn't think that today. You know, Chris, when you and Kirsten Downey, the author of the biography of Frances Perkins, were my guests almost 4 years ago, I ask you the following question. First of all, who was Frances Perkins, and what led her to this pivotal role in American history?
Well, Frances Perkins was a modest New England woman who went off in an unusual way for women in those days to Mount Holyoke College, where she discovered through a visiting lecture from Florence Kelly, one of the great reformers of the late 19th and early 20th century, the problem of the working people, starting with Holyoke, Massachusetts, the textile factories. And she brought her very religious sensitivity to the unbelievable poverty and desperate working conditions of immigrant women, particularly, and children. And she worked those issues through, went out to Chicago to teach at a girls' school, but she spent much of her time with Jane Addams at Hull House, one of the great settlement houses in our history. And from that, she came back east to Philadelphia, where she worked with immigrant women who were prostitutes, and there studied their condition. She worked at the Wharton School. And through all this, she realized that while there was a role for people in the settlement houses to deal with the actual problem of particular women, that there were systemic issues that needed to be dealt with. And so she came up to New York and did a master's in Columbia and really became a social scientist in addition to being a social worker, and wanted to deal with systemically with the problems that faced the American working family. And this was quite a remarkable career, even up to the point that really launched her, and that was the Triangle Fire of 1911, which she witnessed. She watched many of the 146 young people, mostly women, who fell from the 8th and 9th floor of the building on Washington Square.
Yeah, so that was, and that was a bellwether event.
That was a bellwether event, and she would subsequently say that the New Deal began on March 25th, 1911.
Yeah.
Which was a recognition, although she was typically very private in any claim of fame for herself. She knew that through her work, subsequently with Al Smith as governor of New York, and then Governor Franklin Roosevelt, finally President Roosevelt, that she took the concerns that were highlighted for the public by that fire to develop a progressive agenda first in New York State and then the country, and we call it the New Deal.
Yeah, well, you brought us right up to the United States in 1933 when FDR was sworn into office. It was in the throes of the greatest economic disaster the United States and the world had experienced. The president had put together a cabinet which was composed of some of the outstanding public servants and other political people that represented different regions and political perspectives. Chris, how pivotal was Frances Perkins to the New Deal, and what was the condition of working America that she found as the newly appointed Secretary of Labor?
The condition of working people was really desperate, and the anti-union sentiment, which had dominated the country up to that point, particularly the Republican administrations after World War I, meant that the working man really had no protection. And she, from the very beginning, although the labor leaders were not real thrilled to have a woman as Secretary of Labor, she began as an ardent advocate for working people. She would say, "I came to Washington to work for God, FDR, and the millions of forgotten, plain, common working men." And that is really a very terse, concise statement of what she was all about. And she worked in the policy formation area. She listed, as you've inferred, when she met the president-elect in 1933, when he asked her to be Secretary of Labor, she listed the things that she would want his support for. And they included unemployment insurance, workman's comp, 40-hour work week, minimum wage, protection for women workers, ending child labor, Social Security, and a national health system. Mm-hmm. And she pressed Roosevelt to say he supported it. She used to tell me that she had an envelope in which she'd written these all down in her top right-hand drawer, and when she completed it, she would cross it off. Mm-hmm. So I think you can say that she was extraordinarily successful in carrying out a policy structure that came to the protection of people in general, but particularly working people and their families.
Well, that was
as much focused on women,
right,
as it was on men.
Well, that was an agenda, and that's really what elects a president. And the question is, there's always course corrections along the way and what can be achieved, but it's amazing in that litany of what you mentioned was what really was achieved and what is expected. These things are expected. These aren't things that come and go with the whim of political breeze. You know, the world of labor in America in those dark days of the Great Depression was dominated by a rough and tumble blue-collar all-boy network. We know that. It's not hard to imagine. We see it in the movies. Women really had very little place. How difficult was the first woman cabinet officer who was a product of Mount Holyoke College to be accepted in that most difficult role? She must have faced some incredible personal trauma.
Well, she had learned early to deal with men. And she did that in New York in the National Consumers League. And she made her first great success in getting a 54-hour work provision for women by working with Tammany Hall. And the leaders of Tammany became her allies, which tells you a little bit about her political sophistication. In August of 1933, just after the first 100 days, which are so famous under Roosevelt, Time magazine had her on their cover story. It's actually a wonderful portrait of her. And this paragraph tells you a lot. It is no accident, this is quoting Time now, that the resurgence of labor coincides with the presence in the cabinet of its first woman, and she in the Labor Department. And Madam Secretary Perkins has concentrated all the philosophy of the New Deal and most of its instinctive sympathy for the working man. Early and late, she has served as his able, that is the working man's able, articulate spokesman around the cabinet table, before congressional committees at NRA, that's the National Recovery Act, hearings on the stump. For the first time in years, the working man may feel that there is a trained mind functioning for him in Washington. Gone are the easy platitudes of the politician. Ms. Perkins speaks the idiom of the advanced welfare worker, scientific sociologist.
That's perfectly said in a sense. Also, I want you to dwell on something that not many people talk about, not really reflective of the labor leaders, but how was she treated by her peers in FDR's cabinet? Remember, she's the first woman. And also with the staff of the Labor Department. Was there a period where she felt very lonely and isolated?
Well, I'm not sure. As Secretary of Labor, she watched herself very carefully with the members of the cabinet, and clearly she was on tender hooks with them. They kind of felt she talked too much, and she tried to hold that back. But clearly, Roosevelt's respect for her, and he'd worked with her for his 4 years as governor, meant that she, people understood rather quickly around the cabinet table that she had his ear on the vital policy formation. And she became very close to the Secretary of Agriculture, who was Henry Wallace, and I got to witness their friendship, which was very deep. And he was her favorite person on the cabinet. So I think she learned how to handle that role, but she'd learned it earlier, which is why I brought up the Tammany. She changed her name from Fanny to Frances. She put on long black skirts, typically with a black top over a white blouse, so that she looked very matronly. She wore her tricorn hat. And she said if she could make people feel that they were talking to their mother, men talking to their mother, that she could get what she wanted. So she had already developed a way of, if you will, manipulating her relationship with men who did not expect to deal seriously with a woman. And I think Roosevelt, who if you knew nothing else about him, you know that he really appreciated women.
Oh, yes.
And was very influenced by his mother, by Eleanor, by Missy LaHand, by Lucy. He had great respect for women, and Frances was one of those that was there for the whole time.
Well, you know, it's very interesting, and the study of FDR's cabinet is a remarkable one. Certainly characters and people like Henry Morgenthau, Harry Hopkins, Henry Wallace, when he was a member of the cabinet, one of the great secretaries of agriculture, and Harold Ickes. Those seem to be, and of course Francis Perkins, those people were the mainstay of the New Deal, and the rest, of course, came and went reflective of the political situation, time, and whatever other interests they have. But it is interesting to see that part of his style was to compartmentalize his cabinet people, to keep them separate, keep them in competition, as opposed to the corporate team which Herbert Hoover had. In fact, Henry L. Stimson had remarked on that the Hoover idea, going back to even Taft, where he was Secretary of War, had commented on how the cabinet functioned much differently under Roosevelt. You know, in our last segment before our first break, in discussing America in 1930s, Chris, she faced many challenges, including distrust, as we know, from the union movement to the passage of the Wagner Act, which is really the Bill of Rights for labor, the right to collective bargaining. One of the things that I know you've mentioned to me was the situation of Harry Bridges. We have a minute or so. Give us a little background on that.
Well, it's going to take more than a minute, so let me get started. Harry Bridges was the leader, Australian-born
right.
leader of the longshoremen, particularly on the West Coast. And there was a huge strike in 1934, a kind of general strike in San Francisco led by the longshoremen. And there was tremendous pressure from the owners, the shipping owners, to bring in the military, to shoot, as Mr. Roger Lapham said, to shoot the workers back to work.
That's
and
right.
Frances Perkins held out. She was in charge not only of labor, she was also in charge of immigration. And the pressure was to deport
right.
Harry Bridges. As an Australian, he did not yet have his American citizenship. And it happened that Roosevelt was off on one of his vacations at sea when this strike took place, and both Cordell Hull and Homer Cummings, who were the Attorney General, wanted to bring in the National Guard. And Frances resisted, and she went through all kinds of very successful maneuvers, including getting a wire to Roosevelt at sea to have him order the other two men to stand down and let her handle it. And in the end, that worked. And there was no violence, of the sort between the military. And in the long term, she had to defend Harry Bridges, and her failure to deport him as a communist, which is what he was regarded by both the owners as well as by an increasing number of very conservative Democrats in the Congress led by Martin Dies and J. Parnell Thomas, ultimately led in 1938 and 1939 to their effort to impeach her for not deporting Harry Bridges. But she stretched this thing out from 34 to 39, and in the end,
she's
Harry
so
Bridges was not deported, and after she did feel there had to be a trial that tested whether or not he was a communist, which she brought in the future Judge Landis to handle. And at the end of that trial, in which he was exonerated, Harry Bridges came by to her office to thank her.
I got to go to a break. It's a great story. I'll get back to this in a moment. We have a short commercial break. You're listening to The Advocates, WJUP FM 103.9. It's Sunday morning, January 3rd, 2016. I'm with my guest, Dr. Chris Bryseth. Our subject is the great public servant Frances Perkins and today's challenge from the right to her vision, the New Deal, and the justice for the average American. I'll be back in a second. Welcome back. This is Sunday morning, January 3rd, 2016, to the Advocates on WJUP 103.9 FM with my guest Chris Bryseth, and we're talking about the great public servant Francis Perkins and today's challenge from the right to a vision, the New Deal, and justice for the average American. Of course, Chris was just talking about the famous Harry Bridges case. He was a controversial person for decades after that, in fact, and how we had a great, probably it was one of the great challenges to whether we were going to have the right of labor to strike and or whether we were going to confront it with martial law. You know, Chris, up until the Great Depression, government had played a limited role in the affairs of the average American. Much of the attitude of many Americans was the Ayn Rand view of intense individualism bordering on selfishness. Maybe they like to call it self-reliance. Why did Francis Perkins and the reformers of the New Deal, all those people we mentioned, Ickes, you know, Henry Wallace, etc., have a different view, and where did that view come from?
Well, she like to say, and we've used it as a quotation for the book Francis Perkins Center has put together called A Promise to All Generations, the people are what matter to government, and a government should aim to give all of the people under its jurisdiction the best possible life. This is what the New Deal was guided by, and in the Public Works Administration, the Civilian Conservation Corps, which put millions of young people to work and help their families get back on their feet, they saw that government was us and that government had the capacity to rebuild America, to build the infrastructure, and in the process to utilize human labor and train it so that people would have jobs and lives of, with families. They could be taxpayers. So government was seen as really a wonderful source, and this is in the wake of Europe going through utter madness in the 1930s, the New Deal made government the instrument of the people and put it into our lives in a way that has been ever since. And the conflicts we are going through right now is a kind of a debate between the Ayn Rand view and the Francis Perkins view. Mm. And most of the things that were accomplished into the New Deal and that had Francis Perkins' fingerprints on them are under assault today. I mean, it's really quite remarkable.
So, you know, in other words, we went from government being an abstract thought. It had been basically involved, its greatest involvement was in the Civil War and then tariffs. That's where government was, protection.
In the military. For the World War.
Right, exactly. And we had a very small military, a relatively large active Navy to two ocean wars. We went from that to the New Deal era, where we had government intervention, as you mentioned so clearly, government dealing with all of the people, having to judge all of the problems. And now we've entered into a different era. Government is our enemy, it seems. You know, when we talked 2 years ago, we were hearing the Republican Party and their Tea Party faction, which maybe is the Republican Party today, and many of the congressional leaders say that we needed a return to the concept of the rugged individual, the uniqueness of American exceptionalism, along with an anti-immigrant and anti-union rhetoric. Now, here, almost 2016, right around the corner, in the midst of a presidential election year, this rhetoric has become louder and more strident. Could you describe some of these assaults on the New Deal legacy at all levels of our government, from Washington to the local state legislators today? Stuff like, you know, Wisconsin, child labor, minimum wage. What's happening today, Chris?
Well, I think the entering wedge for this modern phenomenon, this contemporary phenomenon, was the Affordable Care Act, President Obama's health care legislation, and as I inferred earlier, Francis wanted a national health care plan, and it was part of the original Social Security bill. But under the pressure of the AMA, the American Medical Association, she and Roosevelt concluded they'd lose the whole bill if they kept that in there. So every president since, every Democratic president since, has tried to bring in health care. Well, when Obama did it, it became the crisis issue for the Republicans, who frankly did not want another FDR. And so they used every ounce of energy they had to block it. Well, in blocking it, they made it the Obamacare, as they called it, the point of the 2010 election. And they campaigned against it vigorously, and they brought in a remarkable number, not only of members of the House of Representatives, probably securing it as a Republican majority for several years, at least out till 2020, when redistricting comes again. But more importantly than even the Congress, they brought in all these governors and legislators and have added to those numbers since. And at the New Deal legislation, in almost every case except Social Security, required a partnership between the states and the federal government. I mean, FDR was very much a federalist. And unemployment insurance, for example, requires contributions on the part of the states, but it's up to them to establish the levels. And right after the 2010 election, in places like Maine, with Governor LePage, you began an immediate attack on the state's contribution to unemployment insurance. The Medicaid part of Obamacare has become the testing point of Republican legislators and governors to not include the poor under Medicaid, because the Supreme Court, in their major decision, exempted Medicaid as a required part of the Affordable Care Act. So that has become the point of the spear for Republicans to resist this expansion of the role of government into health insurance. I think that attack at the state level, and which is really part of what the Koch brothers very shrewdly supported with large money and a long-standing strategic effort to take over state governments where redistricting was controlled, was aimed at restricting the role of government in our lives. Mm-hmm. And that has been the siren cry of the far right, even of a guy like Paul Ryan, who now is in a terrifically important position as Speaker of the House, who used to have his employees read Ayn Rand's Atlas Shrugged as a way of understanding his approach to the role of the individual and the role of government.
Well, and of course there is an increase in pressure for right-to-work states, which, in other words,
right, exactly.
And a pressure even to eliminate the minimum wage. We've heard, don't raise the minimum wage. It costs jobs. In fact, get rid of it. You know, I mean, then everyone will work. Of course.
On the other side, as from my partisan point of view, which you will not have had trouble in discerning, the minimum wage is being raised at the local level,
right,
and at the state level in several areas. The Affordable Care Act has included now 17 million people who previously did not have health insurance. And just as Francis Perkins would say about Social Security, that no government will ever really risk throwing it out because it's so deeply embedded.
Mm.
I predict that virtually the same scenario will happen with the Affordable Care Act, and going so far as to say that if you got, which I don't think you will, a Republican president and Senate and House in this coming election, which is, it's possible.
Anything's possible.
That an effort to block or to take apart Obamacare will ultimately, in a wonderful dialectic way, lead us to single-payer single payer system.
And I think, so, and as you bring that up, I think a single payer system is the right way to go. And
well,
the interest,
it's Medicare for everybody. And,
yeah,
and
no
Medicare
question.
Was the logical extension of Social Security that, that Franklin Roosevelt and Francis Perkins designed.
No question about it. And this is
and,
something.
And by the way, Social Security exempted all categories of people initially because politically that was required to get it through. For example, domestic workers and sharecroppers.
Right. Well,
given the racism of the Southern Democrats who controlled the Congress committees, they were not included until much later.
Oh, no question. There's a wonderful book called Fear Itself by Ira Katznelson, who discusses in depth the compromises that the New Deal had to make to get this done. Everybody thinks that large majority...
Crucial book.
Right. Everybody thinks that large majorities are easy. It's sort of like herding cats. You know, the larger majority, the more difficult it is to deal with. Quite often, you need a smaller group, more focused. We're going to go to a commercial break. We have to mention that this is... The Advocates, of course, with my guest, Chris Bryseth. It's Sunday morning, January 3rd, on WJUP-FM 103.9. Our subject is the great public servant, Frances Perkins. Of course, Chris Bryseth has been connected with her in a way that few Americans were. And today's challenge from the right to her vision, the New Deal, and the justice of the average American. We'll be back in a second or so. Welcome back to The Advocates on WJUP 103.9 FM on January 3rd, the first Sunday of the new year, with my guest, Dr. Christopher Bryseth. And our subject is the great public servant, Frances Perkins, and today's challenge from the right to her vision, the New Deal and justice for the average American. Today, in the wake of the Affordable Care Act, familiarly known to most Americans as Obamacare, many millions have now been covered by health care insurance, and for the first time in 50 years, the rate of health care costs has decreased exponentially. Chris, how come the ACA hasn't become more universal? Where is the opposition, and what can be done to extend this program and increase the overall health of America?
Well, as we said earlier, every president from Franklin Roosevelt, and one could even argue back to Theodore Roosevelt, has tried to deal with the health care needs of the American people. And it has been virtually impossible, except Lyndon Johnson with Medicare, which came in the wake of President Kennedy's assassination and many of the gains that Johnson was able to make on civil rights as well as on health care came in the wake of that enormous trauma. Just, by the way, Frances Perkins was very open in saying in the years when I knew her and in her oral history at Columbia University that we never could have gotten this whole New Deal package through with its revised role of government for the American people without the severity of the Great Depression. Mm. So it's only been in times of great trouble that we've overcome a resistance to government playing a role and to see it as a kind of major servant of the American people. I think that the health care program of President Obama is going to continue to be a source of a uniting source for Republicans and unless they lose one of the houses and lose the presidency in 2016. So I see it as it's going to be an embattled program, but it is as certain of long-term success as Social Security has been. And you can see one of the things that Frances Perkins brought to the establishment of Social Security was her understanding of what was going on in Europe in terms of social insurance. She visited Europe frequently and studied programs in Germany and England, France, and so she was helping America as an industrial society come to terms with the healthcare imperative and the social insurance imperative, and particularly in the latter. So the fight over the role of government will be pinpointed on health care. And the great compromise that Obama was required to make, which is not unlike what had to be made with Social Security, was that the health insurance industry was the dominant factor in the delivery of health care.
Right.
And so we set up, we built it around this the insurance. As I said earlier, if the Republicans succeed in dismantling it so that people start losing insurance that they now have, it will create the political conditions to bring in a single-payer system and what the Republicans call derisively socialized medicine.
Mm. You know, there's, in my view, of course, I don't know how many other people, I look at health care as a right for all Americans. We're the wealthiest country in the world. We deserve to have a wealthy, healthy population and make it affordable. To me, that's a given. Other people may see that as, well, that's not the role of government. I do see it that way. You know, Social Security was established with a permanent intent to have it as self-sustaining with payroll taxes and have the funds, in a, as FDR said, a proverbial lockbox for future generations. Aside from the threat to Americans' health care, which obviously we're seeing in the attack on the ACA, where does the nation and the current Congress stand on Social Security? You know, modest changes were made during the Reagan administration. What happens and what should be done as our population ages and our pool of workers shrink?
Well, you know, one of the curious things about this present election, which is really curious, is that Donald Trump is all for sustaining Social Security.
Mm.
And in the wake or in the face of some of his other competitors who are at least toying with some of the privatization ideas that George W. Bush was pushing and got
creamed
by in terms of politically. So I think there is a real issue long term. Only if the Congress refuses to make any changes. But if you increase the cap right now, so I think it's something like $108,000 of income, you don't have to pay tax beyond that level. If you raise that level to say $200,000, even without extending the age beyond 67 to 68 or so, you're gonna handle the financial problem.
Mm. Well, of course,
we face 20 yeah. to 30 years out. Medicare is different.
Yes, of course.
And it's the two of them are both programs that one's paying into. They are social insurance programs. They are not entitlements.
Right.
And the word entitlement has been used by Pete Peterson and others who are absolutely determined to break both Medicare and Social Security. And those people who buy into the use of that term are really helping the far right effort to reduce the central part of the New Deal.
Well, it's going to be interesting in the public policy debate coming up in the next generation, because the truth is that the baby boom bubble will end. By the end of the baby boom births, the 1964 is the last year of baby boomers, the population percentage growth of babies, et cetera, declined markedly since 1946 and 47, 48 through the early 50s. So there's going to be a shrinkage in population as there is in Europe. The Eurocentric population here is birth rate is 1.7. There's less marriageable age people being married than ever in our history. So there's going to be other crises down the road, aside from the fact of aging population and a shrinking workforce. Look,
which is why we should be welcoming immigration.
Right, and I think people should basically be alert to the fact that we're going to have to deal with replicating machines, which are going to make a lot of workers obsolete also. I think those are the big concerns to me, is how can we provide, even with a generally growing population, to have the jobs? You know, everybody mm-hmm. talks about it, but that's where the meaningful new, you know, jobs are, and I know that a lot of the private sector likes to talk about job creation, but I don't think they're looking at the demographics too carefully. I just want to, we got 1 minute before a commercial, I want to have your comment on this. Frances Perkins was, you know, of course, and her generation was very important reflecting the idea of greed versus need, as Eleanor Roosevelt said. And of course, Ayn Rand is the goddess of the new generation, libertarians and the right. Quick question, we got one minute. What happened to this new breed of Republicans? What happened to the Rockefeller Republicans of a generation ago? We'll just have a minute.
Well, there are a lot of them still around, but they don't have a party. And that's a real dilemma. And the part of the world I'm living in, northeastern New York, a lot of those folks are still around, and they're feeling very bereft right now as they watch this competition among the different candidates for the Republican nomination. And I think the role of Donald Trump is so huge that it really casts a shadow over the entire election. He is forcing change in public rhetoric, but he's also forcing change in policy. As I said, he's all for Social Security, and he's for Medicare. He's also for a woman's choice in terms of reproduction.
Well,
if he should get the nomination, he's on record on two policies that most of the party, where it's been going, particularly the Congressional Party, are absolutely against. So
yeah.
There is a dialectic going on within the Republican Party that may capsize the whole party. We may be like the Whigs in the 1850s, in need of a new party which captures those old Rockefeller Republicans
and
a lot of other independents who've steered away from either party.
Yeah,
Chris, not drawn to it.
Yeah, we got to go to a break. We have a short commercial break coming up. You're listening to Advocates on WJUP-FM 103.9 FM, Sunday morning, first Sunday in 2016. I'm with my guest, Dr. Christopher Briseth. The subject is the great public servant Frances Perkins, and more importantly, today's challenge from the right to her vision, the New Deal, and justice to the American average American person, whether a worker or not. We'll be back in a moment or so. Welcome back to The Advocates on WJUP 103.9 FM with my guest, Dr. Christopher Briseth. The first Sunday of the new year, our subject is the great public servant Frances Perkins. Here we're looking forward to 2016 to a great many challenges. It's a presidential year, as we all know. There's a great challenge from the right that's been around for quite a few years now to the New Deal and justice to the average American. Now, Chris, in Republican-controlled state legislatures, a number of states, aside from their blatant attack on women's rights, have been passing anti-union legislation, and they've been signed by GOP governors. Chris, how important was the Wagner Act to the New Deal in America, and can unrestricted capital formation, especially with globalization of American corporations, serve the people of the United States fairly without labor's right to organize and compete for higher wages and better benefits?
Well, no.
That's true.
I think that central to Roosevelt and Perkins' understanding of capitalism was the need for labor to be organized. And part of why the union leaders like Green and Philip Randolph, I'm thinking the former head of the CIO, why they quickly adjusted and saw how important Perkins was, is that she really was for labor unions.
Mm-hmm.
Her defense of Harry Bridges was a key test of how much unions were important to justice for working people. We are presently in a situation where our economy is growing tremendously, and where the wealth has been concentrated in the hands of fewer and fewer people and in the hands of huge corporations, which are now, as you suggest, globalized. So they're, in many ways, they're prime loyalty is not to the United States, it's to their stockholders.
Mm.
And those stockholders are international. One can look at this as a very favorable development in terms of world peace over the next 100 years. But in the short term, it has left the wealthy becoming wealthier and everybody else kind of staying the same or even declining.
Hmm.
And the chance to come into the workforce and go up the ladder, as happened after World War II, when the unions were very much in play, it's just not there now.
Yeah,
but the union movement is coming, and
and
with a person like A. Jim Poo, who's been a leader of economic rights for domestic workers, and health care and home care workers, you're going to see the union movement come back.
Yeah, I want to go right into this. We only have 5 minutes left. I want to go right into this wealth situation. How dangerous, and this is part of the wealth angle, how dangerous to our democracy was the Citizens United ruling? And what would we face with three branches of government in control of a Tea Party president? Quick on that, Chris.
I think that will be up there historically with Dred Scott as one of the classically bad decisions by the Supreme Court, and reflective of an ideological commitment to capital at the expense of labor that will eventually be overturned.
I think so.
Positive side is that as you look at the Republican primary, it's clear that this big money doesn't buy success.
Yeah, that's true. That's very interesting.
And it didn't in 2012. So that while we fear it, and I think it's probably having a greater impact on the state and local levels and congressional races than it is at the presidential level, it is an invidious role of corporate, particularly corporate money. And if there's one thing we talked about earlier privately, and that should corporations be regarded as individuals, there in that interpretation of the 14th Amendment did get locked in. I think to see corporations as individuals in terms of political rights is absolutely wrong.
Mm.
And but ultimately, that has to be taken on by the Congress and ultimately by the courts.
You know, we're sort of running out of time, Chris. There's so much to talk about. And I know one of the challenges I've noticed also is the conglomeration of the media. You know, Koch brothers are interested in buying Los Angeles Times, Chicago Tribune, Baltimore Sun.
Murdoch, at large.
Right. You know, and we could be entering into a pre-New Deal era where a handful of people control most of the dissemination of news, fund all our elections, silence our universities, saturate all our media. With that in mind, we have only a few minutes left. The great success of the post-war era came out of the New Deal and how it functioned and its resiliency. And New Deal lasted probably almost up to Reagan in influence. What are you and the we have about 2 minutes left. What are you and the Francis Perkins Center trying to accomplish in its mission?
There are two broad parts of our mission. One is that we increase public understanding of this remarkable legacy for social justice and economic security that Francis Perkins, not single-handedly, but very close to it, contributed to our national life. The second is that we've secured National Historic Landmark status for her 55-acre homestead in Newcastle, Maine, which we want to make a center for the public to, in an ongoing way, discover the remarkable role of this woman. Just one quotation, we got Nan Kennerly, who had been the president of both Wellesley and Duke University, to come, and I asked her to talk about the glass ceiling and what Frances Perkins contributed. And she said Perkins was probably the very first woman in the history of the modern nation state to occupy an official position of significant political power because of her own qualifications and accomplishments.
Mm, very good. I got to run. I thank you so much for it. Before I close, it was great having you on, for joining me again on The Advocate. It's always a pleasure to listen to your expertise, your experience, It's unique, and I think all audiences are served by it. I want to wish everyone in our listening area, and people can hear this, of course, on my website eventually, theadvocatesradio.com, a happy and healthy new year. If you want to hear this broadcast or any other archive broadcasts, again, you can access them again on my website where all the information my guests will be posted. Thank you, Chris, for joining me again. Hopefully we'll speak to you again later in the year as the political process moves on, all right?
It was my pleasure, and a happy presidential election to us
all. Thank you. I'll be back next week discussing with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Hedrick Smith the revisit to his book, Who Stole the American Dream, and his current thoughts on what is needed for America. Have a happy new year, Chris. Stay well.
Thank you.
My pleasure having you with me. Okay, bye-bye.